Welcome back. Mary Robinson, at the end of the year in Paris, your father came over for a week, for a holiday with you, really.
That's right. And it was wonderful. He had such a capacity to enjoy himself. He always had. And I decided not to say anything about my inner turmoil and how much I had changed because I didn't want to spoil it. We just had a great time together. But when I came back to Ballina, first of all, Ballina in a funny way was very small, much more local after the excitement of Paris as a city. And inwardly, I had changed so much. So I knew I had to tell my parents. And I took my moment with both of them in the drawing room. And they were absolutely devastated.
Now, you were telling them not only that you were not being a nun, but that
I was not being a nun,
and
that I was that I was very critical of the way in which the church was operating, that I was still, I believed in the gospel of Jesus, but I was not happy to go to Mass in the way that I had been doing. I would go to Mass sometimes, but not always, that I didn't feel that being compelled to go to Mass, being compelled to eat fish every Friday, being compelled to, were actually rules that made sense. I wanted something deeper in a way, something more meaningful. And it was just impossible. They were so devastated. My mother began to cry. My father got very angry. I tried to come back to it. There was no way in which we could have that conversation. They decided that I had to not go up to university. Obviously not go to the convent, but also not go to university where my two older brothers were already. But stay home, go to Mass, first of all, every day, and then it became once a week. And go and seek advice. And what I decided to do, in fact, was to do an entrance scholarship to Trinity so that I would have some intellectual work to do. And I did some tutoring in the local convent of Jesus and Mary in mathematics and that, and for a general exam that I was going to be doing. And that at least got me out of the house to study.
But that was a difficult year.
It was a very difficult year and a very lonely year. My grandfather had died about a month before the end of my time in Paris, and I wasn't allowed home for the funeral. It was just too expensive to fly home. And I grieved very much for him in Paris on my own. And a manor was therefore empty, but I was given a key and could walk over there and go in on my own with our little Jack Russell Terrier. And I wandered all around. I remembered our discussions. It was what convinced me again that at least I would study law, because I had talked law with my grandfather as a 10, 11, 12-year-old. And I think I had been affected too by some of the French novelists, François Sagan and others. And I went into a kind of French depression, I would call it. And I remember one day in the smoke room in a manor, which was the special room where I used to talk with my grandfather, I opened the cupboard where he used to bring out the Black Magic sweets, and there was a box of half-finished Black Magic sweets there, and I cried and I lay on the couch and wept. And our dog, who was called Crumbs, came and he licked my cheeks. And I still remember that moment, and I said, look, Mary, you know, I've got to pull myself together. I'm going to go to Trinity. I'm going to study law. I hope I can get this entrance exam, and life must go on.
And partly doing the scholarship meant you'd be somewhat independent of your parents, did it?
That was always important to me, to try to be a bit financially independent. My parents were extremely generous to each of us, and education of us was key. But I felt I wanted to share that burden. That was something that I felt within me. It was a sort of slight independence. And so getting that scholarship was really important.
Why law?
I really very much saw law as a way of bringing about the kind of change that I wanted to bring about. Until I studied law, I didn't see that in detail. But after learning and studying law, ever afterwards, it has always been for me an instrument of social change, a way of bringing about change, and it still is.
And student days in Trinity, the family had a house in Westland Row.
Yes, and that was where I continued a relationship with somebody who was very important to me, Annie Coyne, who had been our nanny as children and who came to Dublin with us, because it turned out that all five of us were going to be in Trinity together. My two elder brothers had used up their residence time in Trinity, and my brother Henry came up with me because I had spent that year at home, so he had caught up with me, if you like. So there were four of us, and then the following year, five. We had this student flat, if you like, in the upper part of Westland Row, and then 21 Westland Row, which was the house where Oscar Wilde was born, which was great. And the lower part was rented, it was leased by my parents to try to help cover some of the costs. And Nanny stayed with us and cooked for us and was a great friend and ally. She read the books that we read. But if she left a note, the note was quite illiterate because she'd never really had proper schooling. She was just innately so intelligent and somebody of great gruff affection. She didn't express her affection easily, but the affection was so tangible. And I confided in her a lot, and she saw that I wasn't going to Mass, and she was a daily Mass goer in Westland Row. But she understood, and I had a wonderful sense of how important an ally she was in my life and later.
A contemporary of yours in Trinity, David Norris, remembers those years.
There's a degree, I think, in Mary of what you might call noblesse oblige. She does, as you say, come from a privileged background. When I knew her first, she was an undergraduate with me in Trinity, and she was one of the Burkes of Mayo, and they had a townhouse in Westland Row, presided over by a nanny. But when you're invited to a party in Westland Row, I mean, you're practically x-rayed by the porters before you're allowed in through the door. But Mary was always above and beyond that sort of thing. There was a kind of a driving force behind her. I mean, she was genuinely committed. She was intellectually excited by the law.
And another friend of yours in Trinity was Ivan Boland.
I mean, we met when we were 18. I didn't study with her. Mary was a very assiduous and admirable law student. When I may tell you, I was a pretty unofficial English student. But I did, in fact, meet her when we were, I think, in our first year in the coffee bar there. And I immediately knew, I mean, in the way of sort of friendships, that we would have a lot in common. And I certainly think that I always noticed in her a great love for poetry, a great love for literature. She was somebody, when you were young, you could show all your stranded half lines to and lost poems and dead poems and all the rest of it. And I bored her to death.
Did you really?
When we were young, with endless amounts of poems. And she always took a great relish in it, always took a great interest in it. And I think was always interested in the contrast between that and what she did.
And when did you decide that you wanted to become important in the law societies and to publish and that sort of thing?
Well, maybe before that. Ivan never bored me for a moment and never would. I just loved those conversations very much as she describes. But sorry, you better put your question again.
You became auditor then of the
yes.
Law Society.
Yes.
And in your inaugural address, you laid out a manifesto virtually for the rest of your career.
I was excited to have the opportunity as auditor to give an inaugural address because I wanted to express what law meant to me and how I saw its capacity to change Irish society, the constitution and laws at the time. And I was very excited by this, but also aware that it was a bit radical. So I went to see Professor John Morris Kelly to get his advice because he was a constitutional expert. And he very much dissuaded me that there was no law in this, law on morality in Ireland, and really I should begin again, go back to the drawing board. And I was quite taken aback, and that actually stiffened me because I felt, no, there is. This is an important issue and I am going to give an address about it. And so I addressed all the issues, the need to remove the ban on divorce in the Constitution, the need for family planning, that suicide shouldn't be a crime, that people should have access to contraceptives and so on. And it was very radical in 1967. And I did feel nervousness. And in particular, because the title grabbed attention in Trinity and people sort of knew this was going to be a particularly interesting auditor's speech. And it was moved from the usual room in the Law Society to the exam hall, which is a big place. And I remember walking into that full exam hall and I had Professor H.L.A. Hart, a great expert. I tried to get Lord Devlin, who couldn't come. And I had a balance in the panel and Justice Kingsman Moore was moderating, who was a good mentor and friend. And I remember the adrenaline of delivering that speech. It was the first time I had delivered that kind of speech, a fear and an adrenaline and then an excitement of delivering. And I felt that there was a sort of moment of silence at the end when I said, oh God, have I not been understood? And then clapping that I still remember as being part of that adrenaline, that I had engaged and I had done an advocacy and it had worked.
And you were agenda setting, weren't you?
I was agenda setting.
Even for yourself.
Yes, yeah. Yes. In fact, I had shown it to my father because I was afraid, you know, that it might cause him some problems. I knew my mother would be just excited to see me up there on the stage. That would be fine. And my father showed it to the local bishop. He didn't tell me until afterwards that he'd done that, who said, well, students can do this. I mean, you know, this is what students do. There's no problem. It was later, as a senator, when I tried to implement, particularly the family planning, that the denunciation from the pulpit came.
And at this stage, you'd met Nick Robinson, who was a fellow student.
Yes, Nick and I were in the same year in law school. And in the first year, three of us got first class honours. And Nick was one of the other two. And I liked him because he was very active, had a lot of girlfriends, but also he was doing posters for all the societies. And those posters were all over college. And he was therefore earning more money than most. And quite often, especially if his particular girlfriend wasn't available, he would invite me to come to Bernardo's restaurant, which was very nice. And we would have a meal together. But we were very much friends and got to know each other as friends. And then I think it was in my final year, I'd been doing some debating, and I very much emphasised in the book that I took on debating because I was still that shy person. I had to force myself to be able to speak and not go completely blank. I was afraid of being too nervous and going blank. So I tried to do a lot of debating with the King's Inns, because I was studying also in the King's Inns, and with the Dublin University Law Society. And on one occasion, I was taking part in a competition in UCD, a debating competition, and everything came right for me on the night, and I won the individual contest. And again, I felt that sense of excitement, but in some way, that was the moment when Nick clearly saw me in a different light, and he kind of hugged me and then he kissed me in a different way. And I was completely taken aback, and I wasn't ready for it at that stage.
You weren't ready for that?
No.
No. But Trinity was not a bastion of feminism. I mean, the student debating society, the HIST itself, didn't allow women members.
That's right. And I was very annoyed that my brothers approved of that. And it wasn't. And I mean, I was a non-foundation scholar because only male students could become foundation scholars and so on. There were always subtle ways in which we knew, and girls had to be out of college at certain hours, etc.
But that was for another reason.
Well, yes, yes.
But did you take umbrage at all of this?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, that's what I was speaking out about in debates. I also had my moments. I describe how I went with Nick officially to at least two Trinity balls. But there was one year before that when I climbed the wall in Trinity with my brothers because there was a lane at the back of Westland Row, and we brought a ladder and I had a full ball dress on, and we went up and Aubrey was at the other side to help me get down the other side. And then all we had to do was to stay in the crowd initially, and it wasn't quite so policed as Trinity balls and everything else is nowadays. And after about two in the morning, we were able to get into everything. And it was just that sense of, I think, beating the system was what we were doing. And we enjoyed it thoroughly.
Then you went to Harvard Law School. How did that come about?
I was encouraged by a very good professor, Professor Morton, who had also been a more exciting teacher, to become a rapporteur in The Hague of a conference on private international law. And the American delegation was led by a professor from Harvard, Professor Arthur Van Meren. And he somehow saw that I was keen on law and excited by the conference. And he asked me what I was going to do. And I said I was hoping when I graduated that I'd have good enough marks, if you like, to get a scholarship to either Oxford or Cambridge. And he said, well, why not Harvard? And I remember saying to him, does Harvard take women? In fact, the first women had graduated in 1964. So the question wasn't so unusual. And he said, yes, indeed. And we're keen to have women. And so he sent me the forms and I got a full fellowship to Harvard, which again mattered to me. I didn't want to be an expense on my parents. And there was one other Irish student there, Fergus Armstrong. And I'd known Fergus because we'd combined together in editing a Justice magazine, and Nick had also been involved. That was important because actually it was very tough in Harvard. And we did have a hot line to each other. I loved the teaching. I absolutely loved it. And I realised I'm going to be in part at least a teacher. I want to practice law, but I also want to teach the way they teach here
and
in Harvard.
How different was it?
It was the Socratic method. It was encouraging students to think. And we would be given case studies about a certain set of circumstances and the judgment on those set of circumstances. And then the teacher would say, well, what if we vary this? Would we still get the same judgment? And you really had to think. And I loved that. I also found the students themselves much more confident. Now, they were a bit older because law is a graduate subject. So I was very much the youngest in that year. And we joked about the wives of a number of these male students who were getting their PhD. They were working to put hubby through. And I found that there was a lot of pressure because no matter how early in the morning you got up, people were up earlier than you. And no matter how late you worked at night, there were lights still on. But I loved it.
And you then taught in Trinity for a time?
Yes. When I came back, I first of all taught law as a tutor in University College Dublin. And then there was an examination for the Reid Professorship in Constitutional and Criminal Law. And in 1969, I sat that examination competitively and was appointed Reid Professor. And there was a parliamentary election about to take place. And I went forward for the university seats in Trinity.
And you won that. Now, what was your ambition at that stage as a senator, as a which is a legislator, but a bit remote from the levers of power, if you like, but you still had your agenda?
Well, I was teaching law at the time as Reid Professor. I was practicing law and going on the Western Circuit. And I very much challenged the fact that the university seats were for elderly male professors. So when I was encouraged to go forward, I went forward very much on a programme to make a difference. And top of the programme was to fulfil part of the law and morality speech that I'd given as Auditor of the Law Society to change the law on family planning. I felt very strongly about that. I felt women must be able to choose and space their children because otherwise they won't be able to fulfil their whole potential. And it was really an important part of equality and development to me at that stage.
And when you tabled that, what happened next?
Even when I spoke about it as Senator Mary Burke, it caused outcry. And the then Archbishop of Dublin, Archbishop McQuaid, said that he wanted a letter read out in all the dioceses of Dublin that such a measure would be and would remain a curse upon the country. I was determined to table the bill, and two senators, John Horgan and Trevor West, were willing to support. That was in late 1970. We tabled it early in 1971, and Nick and myself had been asked by my parents to separate because they didn't think he was the right person to marry me. So we had a trial separation for 6 months. We came back together and we decided we would marry in December 1970. And I remember that it was important for me to take his name to become Mary Robinson because that would seal our love together, because we'd had to fight to marry. But I was also joking with him that I was going to go from Senator Mary Burke to Senator Mary Robinson, and that would bring me down the scale. And people know that if you've got a surname near the top of the alphabet, yeah, there's some advantage in it. So I joked about that. But more importantly, I had become notorious as Senator Mary Burke because of the announced intention of drafting the family planning legislation. When I did table it, for months, the Leader of the House would not, Senator Tommy Mullins, would not do what was done for every other bill, just put it on the order for the day and have the decision that it be published. That was the first reading. No discussion, just that it would be published. And he wouldn't do that. I asked him many times. And then one day...
Did he give you a reason?
No, he just said that the agenda was too full. But this wouldn't take a minute because nobody would speak. And I mentioned that a few times. And then I learned when I was in the House one day in the Oireachtas that he was going to table it that afternoon when the Senate met. And I had to rush up to the chamber. And he was not only going to table it, Fianna Fáil had had a party decision to oppose it. And it was very difficult because I hadn't got, you know, time to prepare a full speech. I spoke in anger about what was happening and that this was an important measure and that it should be given an opportunity and that everybody knew what was in it because it was in the newspapers. Why would the Oireachtas not discuss it? But in fact, it was refused a first reading. It was never, that bill was never printed on Oireachtas notepaper. We did have later private members' bills on family planning too that were published.
And was that the moment at which you were denounced in the cathedral in Ballina.
That happened at that period because it was much in the newspapers that the bill was going to come before the Oireachtas. So there was speculation about it. The text of it was known. There were letters, and I received very bad hate mail, hate letters, and you know, sewn up garden gloves through the post, the so-called condoms. And I was actually very disturbed by this. And in particular, after the letters were read out in the parishes in Dublin officially, that this would be and would remain a curse upon the country. I remember the Irish press the following day had a very big headlines, "A curse upon the country." And I was, I think, just 26 at the time. And this was really heavy. And I really remember walking down Grafton Street and feeling, are people going to jump out and say to me, "You are the devil incarnate," because that was in some of the letters. And Nick took the step of burning the letters, tore them up and actually physically burned some of them in Westland Row. And I must say, I really regretted that because very shortly afterwards, we realised that that was part of the record of the time. We had disturbed the mores that you don't talk about sexual matter, sexual relations. You don't talk about condoms, you don't talk about family planning, and you don't legislate for it.
Was that the time at which you then sought a meeting with Cardinal Conway?
It was, yes, because my parents were very distressed when the bishop in Ballina also denounced this measure and they felt they had to walk out. And
had he named you?
Yes. Well, it was very clear that it was me. I'm not sure whether my name was officially mentioned, but my parents, everybody in the cathedral knew that it was their daughter who was promoting this legislation. And my brother Aubrey, who was working with my father at the time as a doctor, rang me and said, "Look, I support you, Mary, but it's taking a lot of toll from our parents." And he told me the story of them walking out. And so I decided to go and visit Cardinal Conway. And Nick and I discussed it. We would drive
up. That was your initiative?
That was my initiative. We would drive. When I asked to have a meeting with him, we were told that the meeting would take place in Drogheda. We could drive up there. So Nick and I drove up together. We decided that Nick would stay in the car. I'd go in on my own. And I went in. I had seen the Cardinal on, you know, newspaper coverage, maybe on television briefly, but I'd never met him before. And what struck me and still remains with me was how cold he was about the whole subject. He clearly saw me as a Trinity liberal senator who was trying to undermine the authority of the church by doing this. And so we had a relatively brief meeting, no meeting of minds. And I asked him, I said, "You know, what's really in my mind is this is distressing my parents very much. They're very good Catholics. And if you could just send a message, maybe through the local bishop, to them." And he said, "I will pray for them. They are good people." And it was so dismissive and it was so lacking in compassion. I mean, I have heard from others that Cardinal Conway had a lot of strengths. I know from Enda McDonough that he had a lot of regard for Cardinal Conway. But I have to write that meeting as I recall it. And it just reinforced.
But as you write it, you say he was trying to bully you.
He was trying to bully me. Yes, he was a bullying figure. He was large and towering, and I was kept waiting in a waiting room. And then when I came in, there was no sense of a human relationship, and it was a very cold interview. And I really felt when I got into the car, I felt actually more determined to pursue what I was doing because I don't like to be bullied.
Meanwhile, you'd married Nick Robinson, despite considerable opposition from your parents.
Yes, I realised that I had to go ahead and marry Nick, that the separation hadn't convinced my parents. The trial separation.
6 months?
Yes. And Evan Boland, who had quite a short time before that married Kevin Casey, asked me would I like to move in with them before marrying. I didn't realise that they had literally just moved into an unfurnished home and it was sort of bohemian and untidy, but it was lovely because I was, emotionally very tense and very sad that this was the way it was. But I realised that if we got married, my parents would respect the fact that I was married.
And how they didn't come to the wedding?
They didn't come to the wedding. When one of my brothers, Henry, said he would like to come, I actually agreed with my brother Oliver that it was better that none of them came so that there would not be a divide in the family. A first cousin of mine was my bridesmaid. She was the only member from my side of the family. All of Nick's family came and some of our mutual friends, a lot of our friends came.
Must have been very hurtful to you, though, that it was in such circumstances that you are getting married.
It was. I was even, you know, wondering who would give me away. And I decided to ask Judge John Kenny, who'd been a mentor in the courts. And he did a beautiful job. He came with the Rolls Royce that morning to Ivan and Kevin's home. And on the way to the church, we were married in the Catholic church at the airport. He didn't talk about anything personal. He knew that he'd actually been involved in me becoming Reed Professor, and we talked about the Senate and we talked about objective things. Mass itself was performed by Father Jack Kelly, the Jesuit friend of mine whom I had known from my student days, and also the Dean of Christchurch, who was a friend of the Robinson family. And it was a very happy wedding, despite the fact that my family weren't there, in the sense that I was really overjoyed at last to be linked with Nick. I decided to take his name to seal the bond. He loved the idea of me being Mrs. Robinson, and he hates when I'm called Ms. Robinson. It's an interesting thing.
He's old-fashioned in that regard. Yeah. And your parents, did they come round then?
In fact, when we came back, I wanted to be in touch with my parents, but my pride held me back. And I was invited to go to take part in an interview in Belfast with Barbara Castle, a television interview. And Nick and I drove up. The ice was bad on the road and we had a minor problem. We skidded off the road. And by coincidence, immediately a tractor came by, driven by a woman, which was a bit unusual in those days. And she saw us and had a rope and pulled us out. And I went up and did the interview. But it really occurred to me, what if I had been badly injured or killed? What would that do to my parents? So as soon as I got back to Dublin, I rang Westland Row. I knew my mother was there with my brother Henry, who had married a few months beforehand, and his wife Barbara. And as soon as I talked to my mother, it was just seamless. We met the following day for coffee. She invited Nick to come down at the weekend. We bought a bottle of champagne on the way. And we didn't talk about it. We didn't dwell on it. My parents were never ones for talking these things through in that way. We just celebrated and then went on from there. And Nick was very generous in never holding a grudge. He understood that my parents were suffering from a kind of overlove. Nobody was good enough for their daughter. And that was really the problem. As soon as we were married and they got to know Nick, it was a great relationship. And with my mother, while she was still alive, but for much, much longer with my father, they were great friends.
Mary Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mary Robinson's autobiography, Everybody Matters, is published by Hodder and Stoughton. Tomorrow night, the 1970s and 80s, her impact as a lawyer and as a senator.
I realised that we could take cases that would become what we call test cases, and a case for one individual could affect a whole range of people, and I loved those cases.
Her surprise candidature, and even greater surprise victory in the 1990 presidential election.
The women of Ireland, Manon Aheron, who instead of rocking the cradle, rocked the system.
That's tomorrow night, just after the 10 o'clock evening news on RTE Radio 1.